Let me tell you, let me tell you, let me tell you the truth. Keep it on the down low, keep it on the down low, get on down to the down low.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Download Podcast. I'm Laura Chanette. It's officially dumping snow here in Telluride, and you can feel the stoke moving through town. Fresh tracks are constantly being replenished, and the smiles are infectious as people carry their skis through the streets. When I first came here back in 2011, I remember being blown away by the energy that a crazy snow day brought. People were so excited about the powder. Since then, I've learned to ski, and let me tell you, now it all makes sense. A couple of other exciting things have happened recently. The Download turned 5. 5 years ago, back in November 2014, we had our very first live event. It was downstairs at the Fly Me to the Moon Saloon, and our theme was family and holidays. We featured stories about anything involving family or any holiday. Originally, we thought we might just do holidays, but then we opened it up to include family stories as well so that Christopher Beaver could tell a story about his grandma Frankie, which you may have heard in episode 2. We had stories about all kinds of holidays at that first event. Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. We've gone on to repeat that theme annually, and now we hold it a little closer to Christmas. Also, this fall we took the Down Low on the road for the first time ever. We made our way to San Luis Obispo, California, and joined the programming for our friends at Slow Motion Film. We hosted a night of storytelling in this little vintage shop called A Satellite of Love, and it was super cozy. Thanks to everyone who came out for that. If you live outside of Telluride and you'd like to see the Down Low in your town, shoot us an email at telluridedownlow@gmail.com. All right, let's hear some stories. Our theme for this episode is Meeting in the Middle, and all of the stories were recorded live at our Mountain Film event back in May with the same theme. Our first story comes from Dominic Gill.
I would like to start with an apology, and the apology is I've just met one or two of the speakers or the storytellers tonight, and they're pretty amazing. But my wife just told me for the first time that she winged her mother's eulogy, which made me feel like maybe she should be up here, but I'll do my best. I can't really see you, but hands up. Couples in the audience. We got some married couples, partners, boyfriends, girlfriends. I think I see a few hands there. You guys all know what I'm talking about. This is a story about the question, so how did you meet? When I met this certain somebody, I could never have known that it was going to be the beginning of the rest of my life. That sounds a little cheesy, but in this case, it's actually pragmatically true. Because of that one meeting, I live on a different continent. I make films. I started a new career. I'm married. anyway, I had about a year and a half of filth, travel-ingrained filth on my skin when I arrived in Bolivia. And I looked a little bit like an extra from The Walking Dead. I had a few layers of skin missing off my nose. My hair was at least twice as long and three times as filthy as it is now. And I had spent nearly a year and a half cycling a tandem bicycle solo from the top of Alaska down to, at this point, Bolivia, inviting strangers to get on the back. So I arrived in Bolivia, and it was very refreshing. I got to this, after a year and a half on the road, you're tired, but I was rejuvenated by this country that makes Salvador Dali look a little bit sort of mediocre and certainly a realist. There's, you know, salt flats as far as the eye can see, red lakes, pink flamingos, snow-capped volcanoes. It's really a pretty amazing place that some of you, I'm sure, have seen. But I arrived on the edge of this small village called Uyuni, on the edge of these salt flats, and I was hankering for a bit of speaking English. I hadn't done it for a little while. And I heard a very loud American English female voice somewhere a couple of blocks away, and I traced this voice to the small village square where I found a lady. And I introduced myself and sat down, and she graciously bought me a beer and continued to buy me beers for the next 4 hours as we shared stories. as the sun traced its way across the square. And she was on a journey of her own. She had not long before passed the Californian bar and wondered why she had done that. And so you do what anyone that wants to think about something for a long time does, and that was travel to the middle of the Chilean desert, sit in a hut, read books, chain smoke, and accompany yourselves only with goats. She was actually on a weekend sort of adventure to the Bolivian salt flats when I met her. I told her about my story. She didn't volunteer to get on the back of my bicycle, but nor did I ask her to. So at the end of the 4 hours, we said our goodbyes and departed. But before we did, she said, listen, in a week and a half or so, you'll probably arrive at San Pedro in Chile. And I won't be there anymore, but I'll try and leave you a care package. I might have one or two things I don't need, and I'll leave it at this youth hostel. So the next day, I start my journey across the salt flats. Amazing. Just crystalline, searing salt as far as the eye can see. I went from there up into the high-altitude desert of, the Lipez Desert in Bolivia and northern Chile. And it's all between 14 and 16,000 feet. And you go through these, like, smoldering geysers and flamingos and red lakes, like I said. Every so often, I'd manage to find a cactus with cactus fruit to bolster my stale bread and you know, fairly sparing tins of tuna. And a week and a half later, I got to the Bolivian border, and I could see below me in the evening light the twinkling lights of San Pedro, which was back on the tourist trail. It was a sort of tourist oasis in the desert. I hadn't factored in the fact that my fairly princely sums of money in bolivianos, once translated into Chilean pesos, made me more sort of pauper status. So I got to San Pedro and slept in an alley next to a stray dog, which was very much the sort of normal sleeping conditions for my journey. So it was fine, but I was hungry. And I realized I could smell the, like, tourist pizzerias from the like, little high street. And I was like, God damn it, I can't blow, like, 2 weeks' money on one meal. So I waited and I went to sleep. And at about 6:30 in the morning, I woke up through sort of aggressive hunger and thought, God, that care package, that could be the answer. So I remembered the name of the hostel. I walked through town to the hostel, wheeling my bicycle, and I stopped outside. And I said, knocked on the door and woke this girl at the rudimentary desk up and said, ¿Tiene un paquete para un Dominic Gil? And Gil, my last name, translates as Gil in Spanish, and Gil in Spanish also means stupid. Thanks. You're eating into my time by doing that. Anyway, she did have a package, which is pretty amazing. And I took this manila envelope, which was stuffed full of something or other, and I took it out onto the sidewalk like a kid in a... Actually, you'll find out, kind of literally like a kid in a candy store. And I ripped it open and found at the top a packet of chocolate... It was open, but it was almost nearly full package of chocolate-covered goji berries from Trader Joe's and sesame... encrusted almonds. I know, yeah, I can almost taste them now. And I ate both of them there on the sidewalk, and both nearly complete packets. And any medical professionals in the audience will know that the kind of gastric distress you can put your body through after weeks and weeks of very bland, sort of starch-based diet is considerable. And so before I got to explore the package more, I actually had to visit the facilities. And then half an hour later, after getting over this distress, I looked at the rest of the package, and there was a book, What is the What? By Dave Eggers. Fantastic book, I was to find out later. And a map of the stars. And a letter from this girl, Nadia, written on red paper with her email and wishing me well. So that was lovely. And a few days later, I started my way across the Atacama Desert, the driest and amongst the hottest places on Earth. And every day on the Atacama Desert, I would start cycling, and at about 1 p.m. in the afternoon, the headwind got so strong that I figured it was useless trying to propel my tandem solo any further, and I would cycle off into the desert and find a piece of corrugated tin or plastic detritus to shelter my head from the sun, and I would read What is the What until it started to go dark, and then I would cook, and then when it was dark enough, I'd look at my map of the stars and try and figure out the constellations. And about 10 days later, I arrived at the Chilean coast. I'd crossed the Atacama, I'd finished my book. I still didn't really understand the constellations, but I had the map of the stars so I could continue practicing. 4 to 5 months later, I finished my journey. I got to Ushuaia, the bottom of Argentina, and I had had, despite the fact that this was a dry spell on my journey, I had had about 270 companions join me on the entire journey. I then went home, and then something pretty incredible happened. Facebook was invented. And when Facebook was invented, I was able to stalk people that I had met on my journey. And roughly coinciding with that, I also began to dream. I put weight back on and gained a couple of layers of skin on my nose and started to dream of another adventure. And I dreamed of an adventure that was near Los Angeles, or it started near Los Angeles, with an elderly man that wanted to cycle across the States but was too weak to do so. So I thought I'd take this tandem idea back to the States. In order to do that, I needed to shoot a bit of a sizzle reel and go back to Los Angeles. Through my Facebook stalking, I'd found out that a certain Nadia lived in Los Angeles, and I was still a sort of sponging Englishman. So I connected with her and said, I liked what I saw, by the way, on Facebook. It was fantastic. And I connected with her and said, could I stay at your place? You know, when I need to do this, it was very, you know, work-oriented. I have to shoot the sizzle reel. And she said, sure. And then a few weeks later, she did something which would send... Are there any Angelinos in the audience? Okay, good. Well, it will send you guys, just thinking about this, will send you into some mild state of PTSD. She picked me up from LAX.
No.
Yeah, she did. Thank you very much. No, that's not the end. But it would be a good punchline. She picked me up from LAX, and it got better. She picked me up, and I was a little bit awestruck. She was someone from Los Angeles. I'd seen this place in the movies. I'd cycled briefly through it, but that was it. And then she took me out for dinner. She paid. I still had long, dirty hair, and I had a peacoat on and long, baggy kind of cargo pants. I didn't really fit into Los Angeles. She took me out for dinner, and then we went to a party in the Hollywood Hills. And it was at that party that I realized I didn't really belong here. The door was opened by a naked lady, and I looked past, and I saw an infinity pool, and... past the infinity pool, there was a couple of other naked ladies, and I went straight to the snacks table and just sort of grazed on broccoli and tried not to look at any vaginas. And but on a slightly more serious note, I realized there that I had met a woman that was able to both hang out in the desert with goats and mix with these hip, trendy people in LA, and that's kind of an unusual specimen. As luck would have it, when we went back to her apartment, she jumped me in the elevator. And then I fell in love. I spent about 3 or 4 months convincing her to fall in love by sending her bars of chocolate from England that probably melted by the time they got to Los Angeles. But it was about 3 or 4 months after that that she decided she wouldn't mind tripping through life with me, and now we make films together, and we're married, and we live in Los Angeles. But there's always supposed to be a take-home to a story like this, and there is a take-home to this one, and it's perhaps not the most obvious one, but I would say to any of you, particularly any of you that are young couples that are looking at the prospects but maybe sharing your life together, don't underestimate the significance of gifting someone a bag of chocolate-covered goji berries. Thank you.
That was Dominic Gill, who actually just joined us at our Slow event to share another story from this trip. He and his wife were there sharing their film Climbing Out of Disaster, and he was kind enough to swing by for another story. Keep your ears peeled for that one in a future episode. Our next story was told by Maggie Doyne, who was named CNN's Hero of the Year back in 2015, only at age 28. What am I doing with my life? Anyways, here's her story.
Hi, everyone. So if you had known me when I was 18, you'd see me on a trampoline in my cul-de-sac backyard in suburban New Jersey with a mom and a dad and two sisters playing soccer with a ponytail and a boyfriend who played football. And taking the SATs and kind of in that suburban pressure cooker of college, 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 do whatever you can to go to college so you can get on the fast track to success, so you can get a good job, so you can make money, so you can be secure. And that's drilled into you as a white child of privilege in suburban New Jersey. So I'm taking calculus and European history, and I'm in the lacrosse championship. And all of a sudden, I wake up this one morning, and my colleges are out, and I've started to get accepted. And I just have this moment of, Maggie, like, you know so much of all of these things that you're supposed to do and you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to achieve, but you have no idea who you are on the inside. And that thought just terrified me. And I was about to take out all of these loans to go to college and having no idea who I wanted to be or what I wanted to study or what my purpose here on earth was. So I was like, gosh, I have to fix this somehow. And I decide that maybe traveling, like maybe leaving that cul-de-sac in suburban New Jersey could be the answer. So I sign up for a gap year. And it's this amazing, lifelong, experiential learning, cultural immersion experience. And all of a sudden, I'm out in the mountains taking an outdoor survival class. And I'm meditating on a Buddhist monastery. And I'm scuba diving in the Great Barrier Reef with a bunch of kids my age from around the US. And I'm woofing on an organic farm and touching my hands in the soil. And I think, oh, like, this is what it means to learn. And this is what it means to find a place and a purpose. So fast forward, I just say, I was a babysitter growing up, like a lot of us suburban New Jersey girls are. You make a killing. And so I'm like, well, what do I want to do for my next semester before college? And this mentor with the gap year program says, what about India? There's this project there and a woman, and you can go there. And so I'm like, okay, let's do it. So I end up in northeastern India. And as great as my public school New Jersey education was, I had no idea that Nepal was to the northeast. And I had no idea that there'd been a 15-year civil war that had ravaged the country and created 1 million orphan children. I had no idea until I started to see these children fleeing across the northeastern Indian border in numbers that we couldn't even begin to handle in this project working with Nepali refugees. And I see them sleeping under plastic, and I come to love these people. And with my backpack and my young Nepali friend Sunita, I decide to get on a bus and somehow traipse my way across the Nepali border to understand why and where are these kids coming from, and if they're living in such bad conditions, what are they running away from? So that bus driver takes us across the border and up into the Himalayas, and the road ends like all roads in Nepal do. And he kind of looks back, and he's speaking Nepali to my friend, and he's like, that's the end of the road. You have to get out. And we start walking through this Himalayan path, being passed by women with big baskets and bare feet. And even as an athlete, it was the hardest physical journey of my life. And it was here that I saw the raw effects of what war and really intense cycles of poverty can do to a people and to women and to children. And I'm seeing it with my own eyes as the children come and touch my face because they've never seen a white person in rural Nepal. And I'm also just like in love with this place. The people are strong and they're resilient and they're brave and they welcome me in and they're hospitable. And all of us who work in Nepal, it's like you just fall in love. And so I fall in love and I'm going through this country with my Nepali friend and I'm in this trading post town taking it all in and seeing the cold child and the hunger and all of the hard things that there are to see and the schools that are shut down from war because the tin roof flew off and having those moments. And I'm crossing over a dry riverbed and I look to the dry riverbed and I see 100 children breaking rocks. And I try to like cross the dry riverbed and I just kind of stop in my tracks. And I'm looking at a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old and a 12-year-old with a mallet and a big piece of rock just breaking it, tuck, 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 all day long. And I just lock eyes with a little girl, and I'm thinking, what have we done? What have we done? And why didn't I know? And what has happened to our human family that we've sent a man to the moon, and we invented Amazon, and iPhones were just coming out. It was 2005. But I'm looking at these kids, and this is their reality. And so this little girl in an orange tattered dress named Hima looks at me and she smiles, the biggest smile you've ever seen. And she says, Namaste, Didi. And that means hello, big sister. And so I lock eyes with this little girl named Hima and I see myself. I see the reflection of me when I was her age, except I was on the soccer field with my ponytail and dating who I wanted to date and stressing out over the SATs. And I just think, okay, like forget about a million kids or 60 to 80 million orphan children worldwide. What can I do about Hima? And I can't go back. I can't turn around across that dry riverbed and walk away, and I can't go back to college and take out those loans. And what if I do something? What if I walk across this dry riverbed one day and there's not a single child breaking rocks? What if I can change this somehow? So I meet my Nepali co-founder. His name's Tope. He lost his sister when he was 7, lost his mom when he was 8, went to India to work as a porter when he was 9, just changes his life and decides he wants to come back to Nepal, and I start meeting with the local people, and I learn that right up the street from that dry riverbed is a piece of property for $5,000. And I don't have a college fund. I was privileged. I was not wealthy. I've got this $5,000 from babysitting. And I realize that this piece of property is $5,000. So I call my parents, and I'm like, Mom, Dad, will you wire me over this $5,000 of my life savings? I need to do something. And Tope and I and our local team, I start learning Nepali, and we start enrolling these rock-breaking kids into school and reading every book on development and how to change the world through educating children. And I watch Hima's life transform. And I adopt my very first Nepali daughter named Nisha. And we enroll kids into our school, and I start adopting kids. I run out of money very fast. And yeah, I realized I needed like $2,800 to put a septic tank in to this home. And I hated orphanages. They're just like you could imagine with the word orphanage. They're dark, they're dismal. Children are more likely to contract an infectious illness within an orphan facility and institutionalized care in America and the world than outside. And I'm like, but what if I did this differently? What if we create a home with joy and laughter, and I'm going to paint the walls yellow, and there's going to be kites, and there's going to be marbles. And so I start taking in, first there's Nisha, and this work is so addicting, everyone. Like, it's so much fun. And so I'm out of money. And thank goodness, one day I get this call out of the blue, and it's this girl from New York City, and her name's Rachel, and she's like, Maggie, this is Rachel from Cosmo Girl magazine, and I saw your photo, one of your friends submitted it, and I've got really good news, you've won Cosmo Girl of the Year and $20,000. And I'm like... I'm gonna build more bedrooms. I'm gonna be able to take in that kid. We're gonna put a roof on this school. I'm thinking of all the things that I can do and what we can work with our Nepali team. And all of a sudden she says, but it gets even better. And I'm like, what? What can be better than $20,000? And she says, we're gonna whisk you away into New York City for a Maybelline makeover. And I had lice in my hair, but I get on that plane, and Frederick Fekai does my hair in New York City, and Maybelline does my makeup, and the makeup artist shows up, and she has no eyebrows, and I'm thinking, please don't touch mine, and don't dye my hair. They wanted to dye my hair blonde because, you know, America. Like, my kids won't recognize me, but I do this makeover, and I get back to Nepal, and I get back to my children, who I love so, so dearly, and I build those bedrooms, and the story hits Cosmo Girl, and then it hits Glamour, and then I was on the back of the Doritos bag, the Cool Ranch flavor. I was like, I'll take that Dorito money, $100,000. I built a school. But people thought that I was, like, missing or something because it was, like, this picture on the back of the Doritos bag. So I'm in Nepal, and we build the greenest school on earth, and the kids are growing their own food. We have cows. We have chickens. There's kites flying, it's yellow, there's music playing, there's kids dancing. We take in children who have lost everything, who have suffered every trauma, who have lost everything there is to lose. But you realize that there's so much healing. And as my story starts to spread around the world, people say, well, what's the secret? Like, what's the magic sauce? And it's just, I'm going to tell you the secret. It's just love and kindness, and kids can heal. Anything, we've all seen that, right? And so today, I am the adoptive mother of 56 children. I know, I look so good, don't I? No, and there's not a single child breaking rocks on that dry riverbed because 500 of them are enrolled into our school. And 200 women are enrolled into our empowerment center. And the story has just continued. And I've fallen in love with Nepal, and I've built my life there. And I'm here with Cheryl Strayed, and we did this film together. And one day I met her, and she says, how are you ever going to meet anyone? Like, because, you know, she's like a relationship advice columnist. She's like, everyone's going to swipe the wrong direction for you online, like rural Nepal, all of these kids. And I was like 27, 28, like my whole, I'm building my life in Nepal. But sure enough, I went to this event called the Do Lectures, and I was speaking there. And I look across the audience, and long story short, I meet my husband, Jeremy. at a very, very hard time in my life when I was kind of questioning a lot, because Nepal is hard and the world is hard. And even doing everything you can, you feel that there are some days that are just hopeless. But I fall in love, the biggest love, soul, mate, connection you've ever could have imagined instantly. And this year, I had my first biological daughter. we named her Ruby Sunshine. She's here, and you'll see her. She's adorable. And I'm on maternity leave. And I married a filmmaker. He's a documentary filmmaker. And we have to take our maternity leave in LA because he was shooting a job there. And I had this whole debate, like, do I give birth in rural Nepal where women die of childbirth, has the highest maternal and neonatal death rate in the world, or do I give birth in Hollywood, LA? Like, the decisions, and again, the privilege. So I give birth in LA, thank God, because I had everything go wrong. And I'm holding my biological daughter, experiencing biological motherhood after raising a beautiful family of Nepali children. And my phone rings, and I'm nursing my new baby girl, and my oldest daughter, Nisha, calls. And Nisha has just gotten a full scholarship to college in the U.S. at a school called Whitman. And I'm already like this proud mom. My kids are going to college. I never went to college, full circle. Like, I just never did it. I never ended up going back, much to my parents' dismay. So my daughter calls, and I'd already known she got into college on a full ride, and life is good. I've just dropped. I'm holding my baby, and Nisha says, "Mom, I know I got into college, but I also got into this amazing program, and I want to take a gap year." And so Nisha, my oldest, who's 18, is on her gap year. And life has been wonderful. And what I want to share beyond my own life journey and story, I'm 32 now, and I've done this work in Nepal, but I think the biggest mistake we make as a human family is just feeling like the problem is too big and too large and too impossible, and 60 million kids and suffering and inner city. And I have this vision of me as an old lady with wrinkles and gray hair, and I'm on a rocking chair surrounded by my grandchildren. And at this rate, I'll have many, many, many. And I want my kids to be taking a history lesson and to say, is it really true that there was an age where children were not cared for and safe and educated and loved? Was there really a time where kids didn't have their basic needs met? And I want to say, yes, there was, but we did it, and we've solved these problems. And I feel that, I felt that energy, that this is possible. And what I want everyone in this room to believe is that together we can do this. You trust me, I've been doing this and it's possible. And for all of you who are feeling lonely or sad or hopeless or depressed with the state of the world, you just look into the eyes of a child. And that's all you ever need. Thank you.
That story came from Maggie Doyne. You can learn more about her nonprofit, Blink Now, at blinknow.org. Our final story on this episode comes from travel writer, Instagram personality, and New York Times bestselling author Jedediah Jenkins.
Yes, queen! Hello, everyone. I love it here. So meeting in the middle as a theme I thought was really interesting because especially around a conversation of equity and just a lot of what Mountain Film tries to do in the world is to expand perspective and to see marginalized communities, see other ways of seeing the world, and to really open your empathic heart and exercise that muscle, right? That's like why we love coming here. And for me in my life, and I don't know if this rings true to you, my deepest wounds come from my mother. And I grew up in the Bible Belt, Nashville, Tennessee, evangelical Christian, church 4 times a week. And yeah, and it wasn't like fun church. It was like, it was like, no. It was like dialysis machines and like, and horrible. And so, and it was just horrible because, you know, at a young age, I realized that like pecs and muscles were like hot and like boobs and whatever was in their pants was like scary. And my mom like noticed this and is a prayer warrior, so she was like very stressed. And you know, as I'm coming into the world, and you know, seventh grade, middle school, you start to discover that these things have names, and you are there's a name called gay that is also an insult. Complete, everyone uses it to mean lame or horrible, and then you realize that's what you are. Maybe it's a phase. Maybe it'll go away. And homosexuality in a culture that doesn't accept it is a really strange minority community because it isn't a community. You don't look like anything necessarily, and maybe if you act a certain way, you might try to hide that or change the way you speak or change the way you move. And so it becomes this like internal coiled fear and shame that coils very tightly, and you see it explode in kids through whether it's suicide or moving as far away from home as possible and rejecting their families and all these things. So I've always just like loved life, and you know, I'm very smiley, and I really think that was a coping mechanism for internalized shame. I was so afraid of being unliked and unloved that I overcompensated and made sure I was the nicest, happiest, funniest person to basically protect myself. And I was so loved. I am so loved by my mother. She took care of me. She raised me and my 2 siblings as a single mom. We did see my dad, but she had custody. And we never wanted for anything. She cut coupons every day and just made ends meet. And the biggest, fanciest thing we ever did was go to Applebee's. And which I thought was like, wow. And we would sometimes go to the movie, and we couldn't afford to fly, of course, so we would camp. And all these things, like when you're a kid, that's just, you just think life is what it is. It's either you see it some other way on television, or you just like, that's how it is. You have a single mom. Like, divorce wasn't weird because it's all I knew. And, you know, my mom made us go to church constantly. And, you know, I grow up, and then I moved to California for college. And I finally, like, come out of the closet and tell my friends. And yet at this time, I'm so desperate to be good that I am celibate. I'm like, I know I'm gay. I can't deny this. But I love God. God loves me. And maybe God trusts my spirit so much that he put this burden on me to spiritually refine me. That was what I was told. And I was like, wow, I must be so strong. Like, wow. You know, you know, which is hard. And so I basically carry this internalized shame and fear of being bad up to the point of my late 20s. And I reach a point where I fall, like for the 5th time, madly in love with a straight best friend who's like, if anyone's gay, you know that like when you're young and you have these straight friends and they're like in bed with you and they're just like kind of straight. You're like, I don't know. You might be more than that. But yeah, you know, it's like, but it was a problem. And I was like, oh no, like my heart is like, I'm dying. And I've been waiting for God to like heal me, right? To change me. And he's not. And so I need to like lock this up, or I need to figure this out. And so I do all the research. I mean, and I've been doing this in my 20s. And I come to this place where I'm like, I'm just going to walk in faith. I'm just going to kiss a boy. I don't know. I'm going to kiss a boy. So I have my first kiss at 28. And it was great. And I'm telling you because, like, When you're like 14 and you have your first kiss and it's like, I mean, I don't even know, but you're like, so, but I was like, I got this. Like, I had my girlfriends teach me, which was a challenge. It was gross, but it was like learning, you know? I was like, And so I remember my friend Natalie goes, less like eating a sandwich. thank God she taught me. So bringing it back to the wounds. So I am a master at like song and dance. And so not talking about these hard things with my mom. Like I am out, I am kissing, I am dating a boy. Not talk. I mean, she lives in Tennessee. I live in Los Angeles. It's very easy to live like this bifurcated life. And I start basically coming out to her more because she'll tell me things like, "Oh, I know you're living this lifestyle, but I just pray every day that God will lead a woman into your life and inflame your passions." And I'm like, I think that's assault, but maybe it's like. I hope not, but whatever. And so leaping forward, so I do this, like, I have to find myself. I've just, like, had a boyfriend. I've had sex for the first time at 30, which was also great. And and so I am stepping into my truth and living this life. And I decide I really want to be a writer, so I take this bicycle trip from Oregon to Patagonia, which took a year and a half, and my mom comes to finish the trip with me. And in the process of this trip, I have unpacked my evangelical faith. I have, like, found mysticism and a holistic view of, like, all paths and just this broadening of my spirit in such a profound way. And my mom comes to join me on the trip, and we go on this final hike, and it's the last day, and we're hiking up the Torrestal Pine, and it's 6 miles up and 6 miles down. She's 67 and, like, had a Nordic track, but it's not like she's used it. She's like, I got a Nordic track, and I'm like, it's like a relic. I don't even know if the, like, legs move. But she's like, I'm doing the hike. So we go, and she's, like, moving at a pace. Like, we have 6 miles to go. We get there late, like 3 p.m. It gets dark at 9. And she's moving, like, she's like, a fern. Oh, my God. And literally, like, Mom, let's roll. She's like, I'm going at my own pace. So I go all the way up. And she's so late. And I'm waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting at the top. Now it's, like, sunset. And we're 6 miles in. And I'm like, she must have turned around. So I start going down, and right there at the very end of the hike, she just, like, comes around. And she's made it, which is, like, so moving to me. She's, like, 67 and killing it. She's climbed a whole mountain 6 miles straight up. She's got two walking sticks. We start going back, and she's exhausted, okay? And it's getting dark. I'm like, Mom, this is dangerous. The rangers leave. We're 6 miles into the wilderness, and we have to get back. And then it starts pouring rain. And it's freezing, Patagonia. And we're walking in the pitch black, okay? We're walking in the pitch black. And it's now maybe midnight, so it's been dark for 2 hours. We've been moving, and I don't know what your relationships are like with your parents. I've never seen my mom weak. She is just the strongest person in the world. I mean, she raised three kids by herself. She is an incredible person. And just, it was a very powerful thing to hear her saying just quietly to herself, my knees, you know, just, and then she would try to say something positive, just like, I'm so thankful for my walking sticks. And it's sleeting, and it's so dark, I can't see the trail at all. And so luckily the trail is made of pebbles, and then it's like very flat shrubs. So I'm scooting my feet like this to feel the pebbles. And then when I get off trail, I'll feel shrubs. And that's the only way. And we do that for an hour. We come up, and I remember there's this one bridge over a creek. And that was right at the beginning of the trail, around, and then there's the parking lot. So I know we're home. And I start I'm excited, so I start walking a little faster. And my mom, it's raining so loud, she can't hear me stepping anymore. And I hear her cry out my name in a way that I have never heard in my life, of fear. She cries out my name and says, "I'm scared." And so I go, and I can't even tell you, something hits me so hard. And I didn't know what it was at the time, but the most profound feeling. And I go back and I take her by the hand. I just lead her through the dark, around the bend, and there we are at the car, and she's so grateful, and she can't even talk. And we sit down, and there's a little hotel where we parked, and we sit down, and it's 1 a.m. We're just in the lobby, and she just, in her last breath she can get out of the day, she just says, "I'm so proud of you." And that unlocked something for me that I could never go back, in the sense of, she had always been this force of nature that had wanted me to be someone different, that didn't accept me, that loved me in her own way, but not in the way I needed her to love me, not enough. And in that moment, she became a person, a scared girl in the dark. And something in my brain rewired forevermore, and she was dethroned from this scary force into this beautiful human who had loved me the best she could and was on a journey in the dark. I remember, now I'm 36, I have friends with kids now, and their kids go to bed, and we drink wine and laugh. And I'm like, and I just last year asked my mom, I go, "Mom, when all of us kids were in bed, did you, like, have friends over?" And, like, I never even thought about it. Like, I thought you disappeared when I went to sleep. and she goes, "No, I was so tired and so scared, I just read my Bible and went to bed." And the church and that Bible was, and God was what kept her alive, raising 3 kids by herself. And so I just want to leave you with this quote, and I don't know if it'll land on you the way that it did me, but it's paraphrased as, "If you knew everything, you would comprehend everything. If you comprehended everything, you would understand everything. And if you understood everything, you would forgive everything." And as I have seen my mom, not as a force, but as a human being who is doing her best and fed me and loved me and is trying to protect me, we meet in the middle with that love, and she is on a journey, and I can feel her coming this way, and she is so much closer than she's ever been. And it's just because I met her there, and I see her as not an alien or a force of nature, but as a woman who had kids and tried her best. Thank you.
That was Jedediah Jenkins. You can read more about this story and others in Jed's book, To Shake the Sleeping Self, his memoir chronicling his 14,000-mile bike ride from Oregon to Patagonia, shaking up the norm and living beyond the comfort zone. All right, folks, that'll do it for this episode. Thanks so much for listening. The Down Low was produced and recorded by Backpocket Creative in Telluride, Colorado, with support from Telluride Theater and Telluride Magazine. If you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please email Jenny Page at jenny@telluridemagazine.com. If you'd like to learn more about our upcoming live events, follow us on Facebook under Telluride Down Low, or shoot us an email at telluridedownlow@gmail.com. If you like the podcast, subscribe and share it with your friends. I'm Laura Chaunette, and I'll be back soon with The Down Low.